El Encuentro, The Encounter, November 19, 1493. They came from the sea, their battered sails and black hull menacing the indigo horizon. The vessel was many times taller and longer than the people's canoes, and from them came the stench of unwashed bodies and pine tar. The men who dropped from the ship were monstrous creatures with shiny carapaces on their chests, upon their heads, and around their arms and shins. They carried spears, flags, and crosses. The people of Borinquen were afraid to reveal themselves because their villages had been ravaged so many times that they knew nothing good ever came to their shores unbidden from the sea. The mighty goddess Guabansex often unleashed huracan winds and heavy rains from the ocean to sweep away their bohíos, flood their cassava plots, and change the course of rivers. Fearsome Caribe warriors paddled their long canoes to raid their land, steal their food, kidnap their women, and slaughter their men. Although they were frightened, Borinqueños were a brave, hospitable, and hopeful people. They called to Yucaú, the mighty god of the seas, to protect them from horrors delivered from the ocean. Then they emerged from the forests. Taíno, the cacique, greeted the men from the ship with the word meaning peace, even though armored men who carried weapons seemed anything but peaceful. The sailors looked at the Borinqueños as if they'd never seen humans. They gaped at the tattooed and pierced bodies and swept their eyes over the women with an especial hunger. They stared at the cacique's feather headdress, at the golden disc he wore on his breast, at his gold bracelets, and at the small nuggets knotted with cotton thread around the warriors' necks and arms. The cacique was a shrewd leader and noticed the covetous glances. He told his Borinqueños to give the men the adornments given to them by Atabé, the goddess of sweet waters and of rivers. The cacique also gave away hammocks woven by the most gifted weavers in the village, baskets full of cassava bread, sweet potatoes, peanuts, guavas, and pineapples. The Borinqueños filled barrels with clean drinking water. With these gifts, the Borinqueños thought these men encased in metal, who rattled every time they moved, would climb into their enormous sailed canoe and disappear into the same horizon that had delivered them, hopefully never to return. They did leave on that November day, but waves of them came back, their vessels slicing across the horizon. Wherever they landed, they demanded tribute from the caciques and the cacicas, who offered more clear water, ever larger baskets filled with food, the best hammocks, and more nuggets. The ships would leave, and more would return. Because the first sound from the mouths of the Borinqueños was the word Taíno, the men from the sea thought the people were describing themselves and renamed them for the word peace. The men from the sea also renamed Borinquen, meaning great land of the valiant and noble lord, as San Juan Bautista, meaning St. John the Baptist. They came with weapons that severed a man's head in one stroke. They brought animals that Borinqueños had never seen, horses, pigs, hounds, goats, cattle. They trampled through the yuca fields, smoked the people's tobacco, and raped the women. The caciques and cacicas rallied the people. They charged their warriors to poison their arrows so that when the tips entered the men's unarmored flesh, their blood would flame and boil inside their bodies. When a warrior dropped his heavy club over an unhelmeted head, the macana crushed his opponent's skull as easily as if it were a calabash. They held the newcomers' faces down in the clear, fresh water of Borinquen's rivers until their bodies went limp. The women fed them unprocessed cassava to churn their guts into mush. The men from the sea were too strong, their weapons lethal. They brought enormous dogs to chase and herd the people from their villages, and after men in heavy robes sprinkled the Borinqueños with water and made perplexing gestures over them, they changed the Borinqueño ancestral and clan names to their own language. They forced the women to cover their breasts, their bellies, the hallowed parts from which their children reached into the sun. They called themselves católicos. They called themselves españoles. Their chiefs called themselves caciques, even though none were born in Borinquen from Borinqueñas. Their most famous chieftain was Juan Ponce de León, who lined up the Borinqueños and pointed at this one, at that one, at the other. He separated men from women, mothers from children, elders from their families. He formed them into groups. Then his men led the Borinqueños from their villages to other parts of the island. They enslaved the Borinqueños to labor in waist-deep water in the island's rivers and forced them to rip from Atabey's pebbled, sandy veins the shiny nuggets she'd so willingly gifted before the men came from the sea. The Borinqueños began to die from diseases they'd never known and from infected wounds opened on their backs and arms and legs from whips they'd never experienced. They died in rebellions, their numbers easily overwhelmed by men on horses carrying sharp swords. They died from exhaustion in the mines, processing the shiny nuggets into blocks. They died from terror. They threw themselves into the chasms above the highest peaks of the mountains. They drowned in the sea. Sharks attacked them when rafts broke up as they paddled, searching for another island where they could rebuild their vegetable plots and their communities. They fled into the mountains, where they were chased and captured by hounds. They died of humiliation after hot irons branded their foreheads. They died in such numbers that their language began to die, too, and the names of their ancestors and most of their gods were silenced from tongues. The Borinqueño culture, traditions, and history were chronicled by the conquerors who called them savages, who misinterpreted their customs and rituals, who told them that if they didn't renounce their own gods, they would live in flames in the next life. Borinqueñas were made to lie with the newcomers because the men from the sea didn't bring their own women, and another race grew from their children. The last full-blooded Borinqueño saw another kind of people walking upon Borinquen's ground. Men, women, and children kidnapped, chained, and transported on groaning ships across the ocean from lands beyond the dawn. Like the Borinqueños, they knew the ways of the forest, but they were darker skinned and spoke different languages. They, too, were branded, dragged, pushed, and whipped to work in the rivers. And when the goddess Atabey refused to give up more gold, the black men were made to cut down trees, to build dwellings made from wood and from stone for their masters. The sacred yucca fields were raised so that other crops more amenable to the conquerors could grow, because even though there was no more gold in Borinquen, men and even women kept coming from the sea.
In our first episode, we discussed the Taino people, indigenous to the Caribbean, who were nearly wiped out by the colonizing forces from Spain. So as the Taino population started to diminish because of death and the blending into the colonizing culture, European colonizers began to import African people and force them to live under the yoke of slavery.
Like the Taino people, the people from Western Africa who would become slaves lived on the island of Borinquen and greatly influenced the culture.
Afro-Latinx has become a bit of a cultural buzzword since the Afro-Latinx community began to actively combat their erasure from pop culture.
So today, we're going to be looking at African influence on Boricua culture, and more specifically talk about Afro-Boricuas on Rico and Sueños Episode 2, Negrita.
Power.
You.
I'm Wilson.
And on this mic is Lou. And today, we get Biggity Biggity Black.
On the power of you in fiction.
All right. I'm excited, and I know you're about to be excited because of who we're featuring today.
Without a doubt, fam, I'm seriously amped. Being able to have the incomparable and brilliant Esmeralda Santiago as a guest of our little old show, my stars. Sometimes I still think I'm dreaming, bro.
Yes, she'll definitely be on more this season, but I sat down with the Esmeralda Santiago for more than 2 hours. It was really one of those life-changing conversations. But anyway, I'm gonna stop geeking.
I wasn't even on that interview, which I'm still jealous about, by the way, but hearing the playback, whew. Anyways, that opening clip was the introduction to Esmeraldas, novel Conquistadora. It's a story about a woman who travels from Spain to the then colony of Puerto Rico to become a hacendada, or a female plantation owner.
Right now you're probably saying, but wait guys, I thought you said this was the African culture episode. It is. So, in this amazing piece of historical fiction, Esmeralda tells several chapters from the point of view of the enslaved. I read stories about people who are abducted from different African nations and tribes, and people born into slavery trying to reconcile their existence. These were very specific, individual accounts. How they lived before they got on ships, how their lives were inextricably altered when they were forced into slavery, and the cruel dichotomy of having to care for your enslavers.
So homie, I'm gonna ask you, like you asked me, about the Tainos and the island of Jamaica. Did this hit different for you as you made your way through Esmeralda's epic tale?
Yo, it really did. And I would tell you all about it, but I got to tell Esmeralda herself. She was talking about getting responses of people affected by her books that started out, I'm not Puerto Rican, but, and I had to hit her with my own. I'm not Puerto Rican, but I'm a Black American, and I have learned through my education system, you don't hear many stories of the will of enslaved African peoples. You hear about the Civil War as a war fought by white people on the behalf of slaves. You don't hear much about the diversity of African cultures that was imported here. And you don't hear much about the slave self-determination to be free. So like as I read Conquistadora, I very strongly appreciate the chapters that were dedicated to an indifferent enslaved person and how you made sure to pinpoint where each of those people came from and how they came from varying parts of the continent, may have been born in Puerto Rico, but they all have this united culture bent by their will to survive. And then several slaves in Conquistadora did fight back. And then you talked about the rebellions in Haiti, and as a Black person and a descendant of enslaved people, it's been very empowering to me to hear not one but several stories, even if they're fictional, of different places slaves came from in a culture they built once they were thrown together.
Well, thank you. That really means a lot to me. And, you know, my great-grandparents were all enslaved in Puerto Rico, on both sides, and on both sides on the paternal side. The ones on my mother's side, it's more mixed. But I was not aware of just how close that I had with that experience, because my grandmother's both parents had been enslaved on a sugar hacienda. I learned this after I wrote Conquistadora. When I just started, you know, I went to ancestry.com and all those other looking for that, you know, information, and I started finding those my great grandparents, and I was thinking to myself, you know, this is what it is. It's, you know, in some places you might say something like that and people will think you're kind of flighty, and you go, you know, the blood was speaking to me, obviously, you know, because where did this come from for me? You know, I felt this great need to write this story, and particularly to really highlight the experiences of the enslaved on this hacienda. And then after the book is published and years later, I learn, oh my goodness, you know, my great grandparents had all died by the time I was born, but they were within reach through my paternal grandparents, whom I lived with and listened to. And I don't remember particularly hearing stories from them, but They must have told me something that stayed with me, you know, that's in the back of my mind, that told me I have to look into that experience, because I love them so much, both of them, especially Abuela and Abuelo. I knew them very well because I'd with them from time to time, and they're the kind of people that they were. I just adored them. And I remember that, you know, before electricity, people actually sat around talking and telling stories, so they must have told me when I was a little kid, and it was stunning to me when I found it on documents, to find my great grandfather's and great grandmother's names on the list of the chattel in an hacienda in Puerto Rico. It was amazing. It was amazing to me because I felt like, oh, their spirits reached across the time and generations. I know it sounds weird to other people, but I really believe it. They reached out to me and told me what their lives were like. I did not know this before I wrote Conquistadora. I did some research, obviously, but there's very little about the enslaved in Puerto Rico because obviously they were illiterate, mostly, and whatever might have survived in writing, it just very easily gets destroyed just by the climate. Some of the things that came to me in the process of that writing really came from inside me. And I'm really convinced they were just speaking to me because their story had not been told on the island. And all of a sudden here was their great grandchild, interested and wanting to introduce their lives to people who maybe haven't even thought about them. I mean, a lot of people don't even know that this was the situation all over the Caribbean. And in fact, that even the people who were enslaved in the United States, their first stop would have very likely would have been one of the Caribbean islands. It was stunning when I saw their names on this page and then traced it down and realized, oh my goodness, my grandmother, whom I adored, her father had been enslaved until he was 37. And it was, you know, I just felt like, yes, okay, they spoke. They spoke in my dreams. They spoke through the blood. They spoke however it happened. I know that those stories wasn't something that I made up. It was something that is in me that I had to bring it out into the light. And I continue to do that because that whole idea that, you know, within my lifetime, I was so close to that experience tells me that, you know, that time is, you know, a year ago seems like a very long time ago, but it isn't. Right. It isn't. It's a very, very, it's a blip in time. And I'm very determined to continue to write these kinds of stories and to bring these people into the light because they deserve to be recognized.
Fam, so the talent that Esmeralda has is beyond belief sometimes. And the way that in her self-awareness of understanding that, the way she was able to tell these stories, because as she said, the ancestors were speaking through her. And that's just an amazing thing to conceptualize, you know. I love that it was really a very day in, day out sort of pedestrian understanding, right? Or a pedestrian narrative, because as we said last time in episode 1 about Ronnie's account of, you know, of the enslaved life when it came to the Taino people in Babaguay, it wasn't always whips and chains and lynching and murder and things like that. Those things happened, but it wasn't always that. So being able to see the community that the Taino people built, the community that the African people built when they were enslaved on the island of Abarutain, and having that story, man, that thing just hit. Like you said, that thing hit different, right?
Yeah, man. It's another thing that compelled me in the whole thing. When you read Conquistadora, it makes a point to point out that slaves were normally around our age in their mid to late 20s when they decided to try to escape, which again hits at another level. Because when you talk about hearing narratives of slaves trying to push on, for it to happen at that age I am in life right now sort of creates this another closer level of connection.
Word. For real, man. For real.
Yeah, so if that was as heavy for you as it was us, you're going to need a break. The Power of You in Fiction podcast will be back after these messages. Hey, Brendan. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Good. How do we build your new favorite podcast?
Hey, Julie, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Good.
With great patrons like you. Yo, Justice, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Good. until no matter when you listen.
Hey, yo, hey, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Good.
We're always in your podcast feed, the nonfiction podcast about fiction, Poyuth Pod.
Thanks to the listeners and patrons, Brandon, Julie, Justice, and Avery. If you want a shout out and plug too, head over to our Patreon and become a supporter today at patreon.com/Poyuth.
This is Rico and Sueños episode 2, and we're back. Hope that break was good enough for you to digest the content, because we still have so much more to talk about.
And if slavery is a heavy subject for y'all, don't worry. It's heavy for us too. It's heavy for everybody, for real, for real. So we gonna chill just a little bit.
Yeah, and so now that we got that real tough part out of the way, I want to pull out another guest.
Hello, my name is Isabel Diepa, and I am a freelance journalist, a writer, a geek girl, and I am the creator of Marie Curiosity, a website that is focused on news stories about women in geek culture and science. Our slogan is The Beaker, where pop culture and science meet.
I was just as excited, but excited in a different way, to talk to Isabel. So Isabel is one of my favorite people to follow on Twitter, at Isabel S. Diepa. My sphere is journalism Twitter, animation Twitter, and comic Twitter, and Isabel checks all those boxes. Only overlap we maybe don't have is black Twitter and tweet meme jokes, which is a cool thing we talked about that we don't really get to get into this episode, but...
Hold up, Lou. One, you're geeking again, which is cool, but second, I wasn't on this interview either. Now, was I?
No, but...
I see how it is. This is the solo Lou interview episode. Cool. No doubt. Just would have had my heads up. That'd have been nice.
Nah, but like...
Nah. Go on. Go ahead and tell your story.
Yeah. So, Isabel has been working on a story for some time, and her story she's wanted to draw from the mythology of the Orishas.
I had actually workshopped this novel, this superhero, and I have this whole... And this is the thing that I am going to turn into a book. Like, I'm currently writing it. I'm very slow. I wanted to write a Puerto Rican superhero who was a woman, and I wanted to write about relationships between mothers and daughters, and also just like as a Puerto Rican who's multi-ethnic, you know, like I wanted to write a book that was about a woman who becomes a superhero who she gets her powers from the Orishas. The hard part though is that Santeria is a very real religion, and it's taken me forever to write it because I want to be respectful because I don't practice Santeria. But the Orishas are very real, and I always thought it would be really cool, the same way how we have Thor and we have this pantheon of superheroes who can be Nordic gods. I want to give respect and homage to these Orisha gods.
Psst. This is the part where you ask, why she used the Orishas.
Oh nah, you got it. I'm just here for the ride.
Heavy ass sigh. Well, Isabel's decision to use Orishas intrigued me quite a bit. We just did a whole episode on Taino history, and they have their own mythology. So I was like, why tell your Puerto Rican story using these guys from Western African mythology? Also, a lot of Catholic saints in PR religion are just Orishas masquerading in Christianity. And she proceeded to tell me, see, I just don't feel the same without the banter.
I wanted to go with Orishas because it's the most documented. When I was in school, I double majored in anthropology and in theater. And my focus is archaeology, and that has always been my backup plan. And not even so much my backup plan, but like in my life, I just pretty much want to be Laura Croft, but like with a PhD in archaeology. So that's like a goal that I solidly want to do in my life. Having studied anthropology and knowing Taino culture has been so decimated by the Spaniards, we don't know a lot. We know some of the gods, like we know some of the legends, we know the Yetla, and that would definitely be a part of my story. I don't know if I want to tell you it all. Maybe I'll just give you a quick synopsis. Because it's a story of two cousins, first of all, it gives homage to being Afro-Caribbean, which is something that is often neglected. So like, I'm a little lighter skinned, but like, I tell people like, yes, I am black. Like I, this is a part of my heritage. This is a part of my blood. I'm Afro-Caribbean. I have this in me. Like this is who I am. I'm also Taina. So, and like, no one please send me hate mail. But as I'm developing this, I really want to explore how Christianity, as you said, like kind of stole these gods and turned them into saints and like really superimposed themselves on these various cultures. Like I think having studied anthropology and having studied different civilizations, there is this through line. And like my capstone class was culture and contact. And we read many, many, many different scholarly works of contact between conquerors and the New World. And Christianity was, it's no surprise, like no secret that Christianity was used as a tool in order to subjugate people and in order to kill off their beliefs and their religions and enslave them. And so my story kind of wants to touch on that, but I also want to be respectful to Christians. I don't want like people to be like, she's so anti-Christian. But basically, I kind of want to explore this idea of how monotheism really has become this default in the Western world after colonialism, and how it wasn't always like that. And so the paladin part, so like Paloma is the inheritor. She comes from a family of paladins that protects the portal. And so the journey is how Paloma figures out where the portal is and what her destiny is with the portal. So I don't think I said too much, but that's kind of why I wanted to go with the Odishas, because I really want to explore explore like Afro-Caribbeanism. I want to explore my roots, and I also want to explore how Christianity, with being historically accurate, how Christianity has superimposed itself throughout the years through colonialism. It is a period piece. That's my thing that I'm working on, and I have no idea when I'll finish it.
I gotta confess, that was dope. No lie. I truly appreciate the perseverance of African culture. In the face of colonization, they found a way to preserve their gods while grappling with forced conversion to Christianity. That's amazing.
Yeah, I hear it and think of the constant battle to stay grounded in your culture. I really hate that colonizing Christian missionary tactic of taking a religion and going, you were worshiping Jesus the whole time and you just ain't know it. So to hear that this attempt was combated enough that the identity of the Orishas was preserved is such a powerful thing.
Word, yeah, that joint is such trash, man. But the idea of having a pantheon of gods, you know what I'm saying, stand parallel to the Norse gods reminded me of Alexander's work. And so that's just great, seeing that variety between, you know, our creators and the stories that they're thinking of.
So what you're saying is you're back in this pilot suit with me.
I guess. Give me a minute to think about it. You'll find out for sure right after this break.
Lou again, coming back at you with some more of that R&S. If you know, you know. It's a fiction podcast, so this section is the only place where we get to talk about some of that real, real.
Word, word. As stateside folks, we weren't too hip to the depth of PR influence on media, but we learned a ton from these interviews, and when we learn something new, we like to pass that knowledge along.
And so today, we have a book recommended by not one, not two, but three of our guests this season.
And when three uniquely different folk mention one title as a must read, then you probably should check it out.
For celebrated pieces of Puerto Rican literature, let's say War Against All Puerto Ricans, The Revolution and Terror in America's Colony.
The War Against All Puerto Ricans is basically a history book.
It delves into like the conflict with Puerto Rico and the U.S., nationalist rebellions, gunfights, political conflicts, FBI activity, and the 1950s incident where the U.S. actually bombed its own citizens.
Because unless you study specifically like Latin American studies or Puerto Rican studies, I don't think you're going to come across it like this in this compact way. So this was the first time I saw our history laid out that way. And I learned so much, and I was just like blown away by it. So that's a very important book for me.
That's something that I think you should read. I think everybody should read.
Well, I guess with this story in particular, I guess a lot of what doesn't get talked about is the Tainos and the African people who were enslaved around the same time. Because a lot of the Tainos, you know, either died off or were killed before they started bringing in African people to kind of replace them in the labor force. And in a lot of the movies and history I watched about slavery, because I grew up in Georgia, it focused a lot on, you know, the Southern antebellum views of slavery, where, you know, it was all African American people, which is very important. But I feel like we also forget about the impacts of colonization and the genocide that happened on indigenous people as well. In a lot of these moments in history, you know, we're viewing basically two ethnic groups, you know, the oppressed, which is, you know, either solely Black people or indigenous people. But with Puerto Rico, it was two ethnic groups who are basically being oppressed and ethnically manipulated in a way for the Spaniards and anyone else who came along to colonize the island, which is what creates this interesting, diverse ethnic blend of Puerto Ricans where the Taínos and the Africans and the Spaniards, and I believe in these histories, but we don't really talk about that much. And I think it's very interesting to note how these different ethnic groups kind of blended and transformed into the culture that we have today. Because a lot of the music and dances and food that we have in Puerto Rican culture comes from the African cultures that were brought to the island.
This is the Power of Human Fiction podcast, and you hear my voice, Wilson. So I guess I'm back and I'm rocking with this episode. And today we're talking about African influence on Boricua culture.
I'm glad you're still here, bro. And that was Ronnie talking about two oppressed people on the island of Puerto Rican and how the enslaved brought music with them from Puerto Rico.
Oh, we talking music? I got this one, bro. I got you. We've been doing this whole, you know what I'm saying, Lou solo interview guidance thing. But if we talking music, I got the best person.
My name is Vanessa Vida Kelly. And I am a multimedia consultant working in DC, but I am also a graphic artist and illustrator and writer, and currently working on my debut graphic novel, Manu.
So Vanessa Kelly is a Puerto Rican artist and creator, born and raised in the States, and her webcomic Manu is about a young woman who experiences this life-changing occurrence as a youth, and she's endowed with some mysterious power, but she doesn't know about it as she gets older. And Manu is a part of the Puerto Rican diaspora. She was born on the island, spent her childhood there, but then she moves to New York to pursue a career as a musician, producer, and all of that stuff. You guys should check that joint out. I don't want to give away too much. It's a dope story. Just check out Vanessa Kelly's, you know what I'm saying, work on her website, and then you'll be able to find Manu. Great stuff.
Wow. So you really just found a way to flip it and use the interview I wasn't on.
I mean, it's for the episode. I'm Elmo shrugging right now, y'all.
It's cool. I respect your game.
Anyway. Music is a huge part of Vanessa's family and serves as a powerful connection for her to her culture. And it invariably finds its way into her work on Manu.
I had the idea for Manu for 8 years before I finally put, you know, pencil to paper about it. It occurred to me, I was like, oh my God, everything in my life has led to this story. It's like the powers that be have been preparing me for this. And speaking in the lines of, you know, Puerto Rican culture and whatnot and how music factors in and things like that. So I don't know if you're aware, but And I think actually it's not exclusive to Puerto Rico, but the espiritismo culture of Puerto Rico it heavily informs the sort of supernatural and superpower aspect of Manu's story that has yet to begin. And how that sort of ties into music, you know, my grandmother would always talk about las vibraciones, the vibrations. You know, this idea of like, if you can figure out how to resonate with the universe will help you. And so Manu being a musician is how she is able to express her gifts, having had her third eye closed. She resonates by default. she can't help herself. That's why she's got Grammy Awards and, you know, platinum records and things like that. She's just sort of tapped into a frequency, and that's going to be a theme that, you know, that comes back, because I think it's a theme that's prevalent in the spiritual culture of Puerto Rico as well.
Wow. Those words about vibrations, they really resonated with me.
Man, if you'll get out of here with that.
What? You're normally the punny one? I can't make a pun?
My interview, I'm dropping.
You right. So then about that Black Puerto Rico part.
Oh, I'm getting there. Don't rush the process. So Vanessa is a proud mother of two beautiful, wonderful children. And everything she learned about her culture, she learned from her family, especially her grandparents.
Ah, so her grandparents were Black.
Matt, that's not even where I'm going with this. Just listen.
All right, I'm a chill.
Bet. So her husband, he is not Puerto Rican, and she lives in D.C. now, so she's not around that great New Rican flavor and culture that she grew up in, you know, that just immersed her in all of that greatness. Meaning, she had to find new ways to get and then keep her kids interested in their culture. One way she did that was with Bomba.
So, like, you know, for instance, this past weekend, it was a Puerto Rican group, I think it was called Cultura Plenera y Bomba or something like that, came to Meriwether Post Pavilion to perform an hour and a half of Bomba y Plena music, which, if you don't know what that is, it is basically some of the earliest Puerto Rican dance and drum music. And it's got this history that's tied to, you know, when the people of Puerto Rico were enslaved and things like that. And you listen to it and you just like, you feel possessed. it gets into your bones. And, you know, what's so neat about it is, you know, we're in the middle of Montgomery County, Maryland, and the whole place was full of Puerto Ricans and they're up and dancing. And, you know, I said to my kids, this is your culture too. You are, you know, this is in your blood.
Ooh, I love Bomba. It is some bickety-bickety Black stuff, yo.
See, told you I would get there.
The thing I love about Bomba is this whole concept that inverts the idea of marching to the beat of the drum, and instead, the drums play to the beat you march. Just watching the interaction between the drummer and the dancers and the characters the dancers play while doing Bomba is just wow. I mean, that's why I put the Bomba drum in the promo art.
Yo, I loved what you said about the drums playing to the dancer's beat, because Vanessa also talked about dancing as a form of resistance, and dancing is the very foundation of Bomba.
That's a kind of resistance, right? It's one of the things I said to my sons this past weekend, because my six-year-old, he's a very pragmatic kid. Like, he wants the logic behind everything. Like, and, you know, he was like, I don't understand why they had to be dancing. And I'm like, all right, let me tell you about dancing. because so help me, you're not going to be that kid. No kidding. But I told him, I was like, what makes that dancing so important for us to watch and learn from is the fact that it was a tool to fight back against oppressors. Like, these people were told they couldn't dance, and you know what they did? They danced anyway, and they did it with war drums, you know? I was like, so there is a thing to turn your nose up at when it comes to doing those joyful things, because the world is telling you that you don't have a right to be seen, to be happy, to have equal rights, or whatever the case is. Yeah, dancing is a tool of resistance.
Ooh, I gotta think.
What up?
How much do you know about the history of Bomba?
I know a little something.
Great, then right after this break, we'll dig a little deeper.
Hey yo, Lou. So, one of my favorite news from this summer's comic book cycle of conventions in the source was that the homie Simu Liu will be headlining Marvel's Shang-Chi.
I thought that cast my homie Jun Kim, who works down at the Handy Car Rental.
Same dude. So, for those who don't know, Jun is one of the characters from Lou and I's favorite show, Kim's Convenience, which is on Netflix. So good.
Yeah, Kim's Convenience is a show that takes me entirely out of perspectives that I used to. It starts a Korean-Canadian family, so first of all, they're not even in these United States. And then, further than that, it is a sitcom with a family whose children are both young adults, so there's no kids running around, and it still explores family dynamics, still brings to laughs, and it's centered around Jung, who works at a car rental place, and the Kim family, who lives at the convenience store that is run by Mr. Kim. So, all sorts of experiences I've never seen before, but still incredibly human, still incredibly endearing, and I found myself cracking up through all three seasons.
Absolutely. And just to tag on, y'all can check this joint out on Netflix. As Lou said, three seasons in, with season four coming soon. As statesiders, I think we don't get CBC, which is the Canadian Broadcasting Company. So I think we just have to always wait for it to come onto Netflix. But check it out. And then obviously for our Canadian fellows and friends and cousins up north, is a great show. So, you know, y'all should watch it too if y'all haven't already been doing that.
So I'm going to roll right into it. Bomba is considered one of the earliest styles of music native to Puerto Rico. It dates back to early 17th century and was developed by enslaved people on haciendas. The lyrics conveyed a sense of anger and sadness about their condition, and the song served as a catalyst for rebellions and uprisings.
It incorporates some Taino elements, the maraca and the quaz, which are used by the dancer, and is centered around an African-style call and response. It's a dance form which was born directly from cultural exchange on the island itself, and is considered uniquely Puerto Rican.
Okay, so according to ethnomusicologist Salvador E. Ferreras, Bomba may have been involved in a few slave uprisings, such as those in Bayamon in 1821 and Guyama in 1822. This was after the Haitian Revolution and during Simon Bolivar's revolution in Central America, where every nation that gained independence freed their enslaved people. So basically, the colonizers and human traffickers were shook AF, and they started to demonize the art form.
Man, shook and scared. But those impacts via the crackdown were lasting, man. Even after slavery was over, since it was associated with blackness, it was considered primitive and was marginalized to the black areas. Just can't let our people prosper.
And one of those black areas was Louisa, a municipality on the northern coast of PR, not far from San Juan. It's a predominantly Afro-Caribbean area and considered to be the northern cultural center of Bomba. The birthplace of Bomba's cousin, Trina, is also Louisa. So,
hold up, fam. Lou, you fall into the rabbit hole. Come on back.
You're right. I just find it so fascinating. Bomba, the Cepeda family, Cortillo y su combo. Look it up. But I was going somewhere with all of this.
I speak your peace.
On this emotional roller coaster of black identity, I wanted to call some attention to what's going on in Louisa now. To do that, I want to bring back Isabel, who in addition to all the other stuff she said earlier, also received a grant from the Pulitzer Center and did some ill reporting on housing in Puerto Rico. This is what she had to say about Louisa.
Louisa is a predominantly Afro-Caribbean community that was pummeled by Hurricane Maria. Not only that, there's coastal erosion. Hurricane Maria didn't harm the particular coastal where I'm working on so much, but what it did do, because of climate change, the coast is eroding and the waves are getting higher and the waves are causing flooding. This area has suffered a lot, and there's not really a lot of help that ever goes there. And actually, I don't know how to do Python, but I do know how to do SQL. And I put in, there's this FEMA, and this is available publicly. There was this FEMA Excel sheet of different towns and the need that they had and how much money they were given. And I put all the data, because it was a whole bunch, into SQL. And when it came to Loisa, the need was so much greater than what they were given. And for the most part, the denial was because they were on the coast. And you saw that a lot in New Orleans too. And I look at New Orleans and I see, 10 years after Katrina, what happened? Schools that were closed stay closed. They were turned into condos. They pushed out Black communities, poor Black communities, in order to make way for, new things for wealthier people. And we would be fools. And I don't think this is a violation of journalistic ethics. I feel like this is just seeing history and learning from history, but it would be foolish to look at that history and to think that Puerto Rico would be exempt from that.
Hey, yo, it's like the big homie Gene Demby is always saying on Code Switch. Housing, segregation, and everything.
Yeah, it is crazy. Even more than that, it goes to show that even though it doesn't operate in the same way, the housing segregation thing matters.
You know what, Lou? That actually makes me think of Esmeralda and a question that I got to ask her by proxy about her nickname, Negrita, and how it causes a little bit of confusion.
Yo, her response to any and every question regarding identity was dope.
Facts. She is, once again, remarkable.
I'll start with this term of Negrita because this is really, it was really interesting. My nickname that my father gave me is Negi instead of Esmeralda. My sisters still call me Negi. So that's my nickname. That's a familial nickname. And so when I was old enough to know that I had another name, when I found out that actually my name was Esmeralda, not Negi. So I asked him, why do I have two names or whatever? And so he says, well, the reason I named you Negi is because you were Negrita when you were born. You were so dark. And so you're just like a Negrita. And Puerto Rico at the time, people thought of that as an endearment at the time, right? Right now, it's more loaded in a different way. But in that generation, you did not have to be dark-skinned to be somebody's Negrita or Negrito. It just means the person you love is that. So he says the reason he named me Negi is because when I was born, I was actually I was dark, but also I was born blue because I was born with the umbilical cord knotted around my neck. So I was even darker than what I ended up being. So he just called me Negi for being Negrita. So that's what he said. And so I always thought of that word as something that was, a loving word. And that's how we used it in that generation. And things are different now.
So Negrita or Negi, as her siblings call her, is a term of endearment. You know what I'm saying? A sign of affection in her circle. Now, Negrita is a derivative of the word Negro, which has an entirely different connotation in these United States. And with Puerto Rico being a U.S. colony back then, when Esmeralda was a kid, you know what I'm saying, growing up, it's caused hella confusion, as I said earlier, for a lot of people.
Yeah, man. Blackness is complicated. Identity in general is complicated. We're just trying to piece together the meaning bit by bit.
Big facts, bro. Big, big facts.
I just know for me, learning all that I've learned about Afro-Puerto culture and my fondness for Esmeralda, Negrita is a term I look at fondly.
I dig that, yeah. I know that learning all that I've learned about Afro-Caribbean culture and Afro-Puerto culture because of these interviews and the research we've done, it's been a revelatory experience. Also, learning about the resilience of the two oppressed people on the island of Puerto Rican has been great. This has been a great through line from this episode to the last episode of how resilient and resourceful the Taino people were and then the African people that were enslaved are, and how they created community, culture, and traditions in an area that they did not expect to be in, or in a situation that they did not expect to be in. So, man, like I said for episode one, pride and awe fills me.
And that's all we have today on Rico and Swindles. We hope something we said makes you want to dig a little deeper. This episode was produced by Vanessa Flores. It's great to have her on board for this season. Check her out at VanessaFloresAudio.com.
As always, the homie Deviant Sounds is covering our musical styling. You know what I'm saying? Shout out to him. And a big shout out to our illustrator for this season's cover art, also named Vanessa Flores. Follow her on Twitter at Vanny Flores. That is VanieFlores. And check out her website, VanessaFloresArt.com. You know what I'm saying? I had to do the audio and the art thing because we both can't have Vanessa Flores. The Taino's first encounter with the Spaniards was written and read by the incomparable, amazing, spectacular Esmeralda Santiago. And it's from the first chapter of her novel, Conquistadora. She's really one of the most prolific Puerto Rican writers. Also recommend her memoirs, starting with When I Was Puerto Rican, and just hit that Google machine for more magical content from her.
I strongly recommend following Isabel and her team's work for the Pulitzer Center. It's some super informative and super compelling storytelling. Also, as I said, she's one of my favorite journalists to follow on Twitter. So follow her at Isabel Estiepa for all sorts of tweets on geek culture, women in STEM, Disney, Puerto Rico, and her local beat in Chicago.
You can follow us on our very own Twitter account at poyif.com, P-O-Y-I-F. That's wrong. That's not the Twitter thing. That's the website. You can follow us on Twitter at PoyifPod. That's the Twitter, y'all. PoyifPod. P-O-Y-I-F-P-O-D.
As you can tell, Wilson don't be on Twitter much.
Exactly. I'm not familiar, but I do have an account that I don't be using. One day I'm going to use it and it's going to shock the world. But it is at Word to Wilson. To being the number two, you know what I'm saying? Word to Wilson, that's me.
And you can follow me, who is a little bit more active on Twitter, at Shens the Griot. Put the underscore after Shens and duh, and engage in this discussion about Rico and Swenios online using hashtag Poyif. Again, that's P-O-Y-I-F. And the hashtag for the season specifically, which is Rich in Dreams.
And now it's the website. The website is Poyif.com. That's the website, y'all. POYIF.com. See, I'll be on the website though. That's why I know it. And don't forget to tell a friend to tell a friend to tell a friend about this little podcast here and our season. And also, if you've got the chance, rate us on iTunes. You know what I'm saying? That's a really good way of getting us up in the recommended for other people who might enjoy the content. And finally, definitely consider dropping some coins in our Patreon bucket with our newly established tiers. You can find that at patreon.com/Poyif.
This has been Rico and Sueños, the inaugural season of the Power of You and Fiction podcast.
The nonfiction podcast about fiction and its very real effects on our lives. Saludos.